CFM.
Already my agents are nearing London. And upon my signal, the poisonous cloud will be released. That will be my message to the world. Capitulate, or the same death will be the fate of millions more. I do not doubt that after that, the rest of the world will accept my command. Already men are dying, and in the great cities of the world, my orders have been obeyed.
Well, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The US elections looming, the EU at last. Look at Google's secret search algorithms, which skew the results 30% either way. Around about a third for or against any particular candidate they fancy, depending on who's paying them. Twisting the views of journalists and voters alike. Meanwhile, will Bernie Sanders get to stand in a fair fight against Donald Trump at last? Communist Bernie Sanders, who actually had his honeymoon in Moscow. And the Munich Security War Profiteers Conference this weekend in the birthplace of the Nazi Party, Munich. Something between Davos and Bilderberg. What are the tech giants like Facebook's Zuckerberg weighing in down there for? What deals is he cutting? He's facing a $3 billion bill for unpaid tax in the United States now. Turkey's President Erdogan supplying weapons and ammunition to the terrorists in Syria's Idlib, exacerbating a mass exodus of civilians from the city. While stopping the last remnants of the ISIS mercenary army being wiped out. What is he doing? And Rigid Type has the chutzpah to threaten Assad in his own country. They try and stop him. Our state retirement age is 66 as Macron caves in this week to the strikers and agrees not to raise the pension age in France from 60 to 62. Why are we Brits so weak? Why can't we do the same here? We're disorganised, aren't we? And the coronavirus begins to look like it's been contained in China through tough action by the Chinese authorities. Time to say well done to President Xi. Perhaps. Also, was Boris right or wrong to clear out Sajid Javid's special advisers from the Treasury? Who are these Sir Humphreys, like the special advisers, who stay there while elected ministers come and go? Not this time. Could our senior politicians just be front men? For powerful families, engineering policy from behind the scenes? Surely not. Our sister show, Dialect, is here on BCFM Tuesday at noon this week. Coronavirus with veteran anti-nuclear scientist Chris Busby. The full version of the interview you just heard, if you were listening a little bit earlier. And also nutritionalist Lucy Harper. Also, why we now work for money rather than money working for us. US money reform author Ellen Brown, and I hope we'll hear a little bit of a clip from her in a few minutes' time. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to Dialect, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, I think we'll start this week by looking at the US elections and the triumph, really, of Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire.
Well, it's not a triumph.
He won.
He did pretty well. In the
Pete Buttigieg was didn't really feature. He did in the previous one.
Well, he came second, if you can believe the results. Don't forget that the U.S. electoral system with the primaries is extremely iffy. It's not like a proper election where you've got a ballot box and a paper trail and all the rest of it. Each area of the US organises its own version of this kind of electoral contest. And in some places it's run on a certain basis, and in other places it's run on a different basis.
So why are we so obsessed with US politics?
Because they're the most powerful country on the planet, and what happens there it affects everybody else.
And are we part of their empire? We are, aren't we?
Of course we are. I mean, what else are we? We've been part of their empire since the end of the First World War, and that's been going on.
Well, hang on, some would
say
the Second World War. Why the First
World
War?
Well, the Second World War really confirmed that we were part of the American Empire, but of course, at the end of the First World War, Britain owed the US a massive amount of money. And that put us, basically Britain's dominant role in world affairs ended at that point.
Well, Kevin Cahill was saying last week that Trump is threatening to reinstigate all the debt from the First World War, which apparently had been forgiven.
Well, I'm not quite sure about that. I would have to look into that. But the point is that it's quite clear what happened as a result of World War One and World War Two is that the hegemon of the international system, which had been Britain, became the United States of America. And Britain basically continued to operate, but as a sub, basically we were Muttley to their dastardly. Previously that had been the other way around.
We hear also today Boris Johnson is delaying a trip to the United States after an apoplectic phone call to Trump. That was just a couple of hours ago in the Independent. So what we were hearing about last week was the phone call from Trump to Boris and being rather annoyed about how he was allowing Huawei technology into the British telephone network system, the mobile phone network system. And apparently Trump lost it with Boris. Now it seems that this is a little bit more serious. Boris Johnson's news: PM delays US trip after apoplectic Trump phone call. As key Labour figures, fate in the leadership contest hangs in the balance. So this is against the backdrop of the Labour side of things, but Emily Thornberry has until the end of today to secure backing from 33 local parties. That's the side issue. The main issue is there seems to be a bit of a spat between the US and Britain now, and this is just Boris Johnson getting used to a bit of realpolitik after he thought he was running the country.
Yeah, I think the reality is, Johnson may want to have Huawei involved, and he may be right, he may be wrong, but the fact is, and of course he's tried to limit it and say we're only going to have so much.
Well, he's been
it.
Advised this by GCHQ.
Well, yeah,
like
but
that,
he's been
he?
Advised that, yeah, I mean, basically, if Britain wants to be at the forefront of the coming technological revolution that everybody's going on about, then you've got to buy the cheapest and the best, and that sorry, just the coronavirus. That would imply, for example, if you're going to have buccaneering Britain post Brexit, then you've got to be able to do deals with whoever you want, rather than being told what to do by the Americans.
Now, is this
but
Huawei,
of course, the reality is it's
this
a bit
Huawei
different.
Business. Is it really just the Americans want to sell us their stuff rather
no,
than
no,
they
it's part,
have
it's
the
part,
Chinese?
It's partly to do with trade politics. Yes, the Americans would rather sell us their more expensive stuff. It's a bit like the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which the Germans and the Russians are building, which is nearly completed. The US is complaining about that it makes Germany dependent on Russia, and the Germans are turning around and saying, no, it makes us less dependent on you. They want the Germans to buy more expensive liquid natural gas from the US, which has to be brought in ships, and they have to build new terminals for it to be unloaded, whereas the Russians are saying, well, we'll give you a pipeline straight to Germany, and we'll do it for half the price. And the Germans are going, well, that sounds good to us. Now, the problems with that is, A, the Americans don't want that because they'd rather have the money that they'd
but
rather
we,
have the money.
We've
and
seen
B, it's also to do with geopolitics.
Martin, we've seen time and time again that Europe just refuses to stand up to the United States.
Well, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is nearly complete, and the Germans have basically refused to back down because it's in their national interest to build it, whatever the Americans think. And in fact, the German industrialists are ultimately going to have to do deals
with
the Germans.
The Germans
it makes
go
absolute
along.
Sense for Germany's high-tech economy to be linked to Russian raw materials.
Well, the Germans
didn't
want to go along with the bombing of Syria, and neither did the Brits. So the Americans don't get it all their own way.
No, they don't. There's argy-bargy and fighting. These are political struggles. But essentially, the US is losing its unipolar control, which it developed at the end of the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War. And they basically made out like bandits to begin with, and now ultimately, of course, they're now facing the fact that they're not number one anymore, and that other countries
at this point they get a bit dangerous, don't they?
The real danger is that when you've got a falling hegemon and there's no stable order evolved yet, this is when you have your world wars. I mean, that's one way you could analyse both World War One and World War
Two. Anyway, he's a bit of a pacifist, old Bernie Sanders. What do you make of him?
He's anti-war, but he's not a pacifist. He's not saying that we never ever go to war ever. He's not saying that, is he? He's just saying that.
I mean, it's not
in the interest of the ordinary people.
Is it
in
feasible
to fight
for
all these wars?
Is it feasible? Is it feasible for a communist who got married in Moscow to become president of the United States?
The idea that Bernie Sanders is a communist is just a trope from the right wing in the U.S. Basically a moderate left-wing socialist. Most of his ideas and would be absolutely normal in a European country.
Butty Guy is called moderate, apparently. That's where all the commentators
What that means is that he's in favour of corporate America and he doesn't want to change.
So whoever you want to win is a moderate, are they? I mean,
the words moderate and extremist and so on are used in various ways.
For example, in the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn was an extremist and the Blairites were moderates.
If that's going to make any sense at all we're talking about is where people stand on a kind of left-right spectrum. Yeah,
I mean,
there's always somebody to your right and somebody to your left, unless there's presumably some people at the very far extremes on both sides who don't have anybody to their right or left, but everybody else has. It's just the way the world is.
If you have a left-wing party with moderates and a right-wing party with moderates, all you've really got is one party with two wings.
Well, no, it depends, doesn't it? In actual fact, it depends on the actual policies being discussed and pursued. And don't forget, over time, what was once regarded as radical extremism becomes moderate. Do you know what? When Edmund Burke was MP for Bristol and he said, well, I'm against slavery, he was regarded as a nutcase, a radical. What's he on about? The whole economy's based on slavery around here. You're a nutcase. You're completely off the wall.
He was reflecting the views of ordinary people.
Yes, well, no, he was reflecting that. Ordinary people were the people who got the vote in Bristol at that time were a small minority, and the rest of them didn't care one way or the other. So, in other words, he was taking a rather extreme view against, at the time, what was regarded as a rather extreme view against slavery. Ultimately, of course, that became the moderate view. That's how it works.
Okay, so let's get back to Bernie. This is what he had to say.
New Hampshire felt the burn and ran with it. Senator Bernie Sanders gave this Democratic election its first clear winner.
Because of the hard work of so many volunteers. And let me say tonight that this victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
Well, it's interesting the way that these things are reported, and I mean, I've fallen into the trap, I suppose, of doing it myself there a bit, is that the details of the policy are hardly ever talked about. It's all about personality and emotion nowadays.
It can be. That's certainly the case. It's very
so
difficult.
So what difference, seriously, what difference in policy would Bernie Sanders make in the United States?
Well, he, in US terms, he's regarded as on the far left of respectable
opinion. You'd be
talking
about universal healthcare, things like
that. Yeah, I mean, what he's saying is, why can't we have something like Medicaid for all, which is effectively, let's have a national health service of some kind.
Yeah, he wants an
NHS. Now, that would be normal in a European country, but in America, it's regarded as terribly radical because the poor people should just die in the streets. Because the thing about poor people dying in the streets, it really makes people work hard. You don't want to be poor, you'll die in the streets. You see, this is, as Gore Vidal pointed out many years ago, poverty has to be seen in America and seen to be punished as a means of disciplining the population.
What about the closest runner in the Democratic Party? But before, there was something happened in the last primaries, wasn't there? Where Hillary Clinton really elbowed out Bernie Sanders, really handing the election to Donald Trump. A lot of people on the left still don't get this.
Well, what actually happened, of course, we've heard an awful lot of smoke and not much fire about all of this. the WikiLeaks leak, which probably came from Seth Rich via Craig Murray.
He was working for the Democrats, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was working for... And basically, there's two points to make. The so-called elections to who's going to be the Democratic nominee, there's all what they call superdelegates, who are basically just appointed by the party hierarchy, who can ultimately... They get a vote even though nobody voted for them, yeah? So that's the first fail-safe that they have to keep radicals out. And the second thing is they rigged all of the debates and everything. So the party itself was rigging the debates against Sanders. And this all came out in the WikiLeaks data drop. That was then blamed by the FBI and the CIA on the Russians. And as the Russians pointed out, even if we had hacked it out, the point is it discredits American democracy because American democracy is rigged. It's as rigged as elections to the Cuban Communist Party or whatever. It's a fix. And, of course, the ultimate thing that's really bizarre in the US is because of the Electoral College, Hillary Clinton, who I certainly wouldn't have voted for, got 3 million votes more than Donald Trump. But Donald Trump wins because the whole thing's rigged.
Don't you have a similar thing in the Labour Party?
Well, we used to have a very Byzantine structure whereby it was based on syndicalist ideas. So the trade unions had one third of the say, the constituency parties had another
third. It's not that difficult to take over a trade union, is it? I mean,
well, no, exactly. So in other words, that was a semi-democratic setup. But what you've got in the US is these primaries officially run by the government.
Why don't you just have in the Labour Party one member, one vote?
Well, that's what we've moved towards. That's what we've done. It's taken a while. And, of course, what was always presumed is if you move towards one member on vote, that would make the party... They see, what people forget is that the trade unions in the past were the moderates who blocked the constituency parties for pushing more radical policies. And once you've taken away the trade unions, don't forget the trade unions say, well, hang on a minute, we're providing the money, yeah? That's important, isn't it? And therefore,
we're talking about the US election, let's also look at this Labour leader contest. Keir Starmer has made his pitch for the Labour leadership on a promise to retain the party's left-wing policies while also being pragmatic and electable. Yet, as Oliver Eagleton writes, look at his chequered career to date puts his left credentials in severe doubt. Now, this is an article from Verso Books at the end of last month. He's really talking about what Keir Starmer was up to when he was in charge of Crown Prosecution Service and in those decisions that were made there, which do make it appear like he simply will do anything the establishment tells him to do, Martin.
Well, he's in the traditional terminology you were using earlier, he is a more moderate person, i.e. he basically went along with the deep state stuff on things like rendition and so on. Yeah, that's him. On the other hand, because he's trying to win over the left-wing electorate that he has to win over to be the leader of the Labour Party, he's trying to suggest that he's not as boring as he looks and that he's got some radical principles. Okay, but he's no Jeremy Corbyn.
Okay, I'll put a link up to that article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you're interested in getting a little bit deeper into who is Keir Starmer and what's his track record. Because, of course, if Labour does elect somebody with a dodgy track record, that is just going to be thrown at them throughout their career. So let's go back over to the United States elections and hear now from the main contender at the moment with Bernie Sanders for the Democratic nomination. That's Pete Buttigieg.
And I know that when you talk this way, you might get dismissed as a naive newcomer.
I can't hear it, sir.
But a fresh outlook is what makes new beginnings possible. It is how we build a new majority. And election after election has shown us that putting forward a new perspective is how Democrats win the White House, and we will win the White House.
Well, I mean, that's just rah, 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 isn't it? We're going to win,
so what
vote
is it,
for me.
What is the detail of the difference between these two characters?
Well, to be honest, I know a lot more about Bernie Sanders than I know about him, because Bernie Sanders has been a senator for Vermont for many years, and he's got a track record of voting, for example, against the Iraq War and various other things that he's voted. We know who he is and what he stands for. A bit like Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah, he's been around for a long time, so you know exactly what he stands for. Whereas what you've got with some new person just, you know, coming into the view of the wider audience watching this contest, is I don't really know what the other guy stands for at all, because I don't know anything about
it. What about who backs him?
Oh, well, what's pretty clear is that the Iowa caucus, which was such a disaster because they were using these new social media tools to tabulate the result, his backers, Buttigieg's backers, had funded the use of these social media tools, and it was funded by very pro-Israeli billionaires. Not surprisingly. I mean, we can put a link. I sent you a link about this some weeks ago. Yeah, we could put a link up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, so people can check this for themselves. Basically, this is a dirty contest.
Okay, well, staying with the United States, we hear this week that Ann Sikulis, who knocked down and killed a British guy outside Croughton, RAF Croughton, which is really USAF Croughton, apparently was working for the Central Intelligence Agency over here. So I thought CIA people went round kind of spying and bumping people off, but not running them down in their cars by accident, supposedly.
Well, yes, but sometimes apparently she's got a history of drunk driving, and she, even though she's a CIA, whatever. And I suppose if you are a CIA agent who thinks that the CIA are going to cover you, whatever, then it does make you a bit reckless before you get in the car, doesn't it?
Above the law, isn't it?
Well, that's right. That's right.
It is widely reported that Ana Sikulis is in fact a CIA operative. Now we know that the Foreign Secretary misled the Dunn family, who are being denied justice by the US government. Will the Prime Minister commit to his removal from office tomorrow in his reshuffle?
Prime Minister!
What a stupid man.
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman knows very well that the Foreign Office have been told that Ann Sikulis was notified to the UK government as a spouse with no official role. And we will continue without fear or favour to seek justice for Harry Dunn and for his family. And we will continue to seek the extradition of Ann Sikulis from the United States.
But they won't get it, Martin, will they?
It doesn't look like it. And it's pretty clear what the relationship between us and them is.
I mean, isn't this turning into a little bit of a sort of tennis match between Julian Assange on the one hand, who's here in Britain, who the Americans want, to Ann Sikulis, who's in America, who the Brits want?
Well, I was asked this on RT the other week, and I think there's no real comparison. Assange has done nothing. Basically, he's being persecuted.
I mean, what I'm saying,
by a completely illegal
process. What I'm saying
is,
doesn't this amount to the way diplomacy, if you are a little power controlled by an empire, works nowadays? You have to have some sort of bargaining chip, and it looks as if Assange is becoming like a bargaining chip.
Well, he's not really a bargaining chip, because the British authorities have basically caved in completely to US pressure and are persecuting.
Well, they
the
haven't
guy.
Extradited him, have they?
They haven't extradited him yet, because there's no basis on which he could be extradited in British law. He's committed no crime in Britain, or no crime in British law. So there isn't really an extradition. He shouldn't even be in prison. There shouldn't be a case against him. So the British are going all out to do what the American deep state wants. And then they ought to, what they would like to see, don't get the British authorities help to get the Sikulis out of the country, because they realised it was going to cause a scandal. Now, no doubt the Americans are very unhappy that she run this boy over, and it's called cause a great deal of embarrassment. But ultimately, they will look after their own. They usually do.
The Mail on Sunday reported officials on both sides of the Atlantic saying that actually Ann Sikulis was a more senior spy than her husband.
Indeed. So when Boris Johnson says we were told that she had no status, blah, 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 he's bluffing. People did know who she was. That's why the British helped to get her out of the country. How did she leave the country in those circumstances? She should have been arrested, and if she was going to abscond, she should have been put in prison. But she didn't. She managed to slip away. How come?
Okay, so just staying with the United States a little, we are also looking at Turkey and the Turkish involvement this week in Idlib, because I've seen a lot of news reports about how terrible the situation in Idlib, in Syria, in northwest Syria, is for for the civilians there who are being having to evacuate the city because of what the Russians and the Syrian Arab Army thought was going to be basically a mopping up operation. Now what's happened is the Turkish army, which is not far away, Turkey itself is not far away, are now in Syria, and they are supplying the terrorists in Idlib with ammunition and with weapons. So it's making it a much, much, much more difficult city to take than it would otherwise have been.
Well, that's always been the case. I mean, basically, the whole jihadi insurgency inside Syria was orchestrated from Turkey. And we were talking last week about Shamira Begum being taken, you know, groomed to go out there by Canadian intelligence service person. Yeah, which ultimately the Turkish police got to the bottom of, you know, arrested the guy. But of course, they were then subsequently accused of treason. Now, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, this war has been going on. You know, you remember at the beginning of the war, they're going, Assad must go, Assad must go, Assad must go. He's going to go in 2 weeks. He's going to go in 2 months. He's going to go in 6 months. Years later, he's still there, having won the election in 2014, which the West refused to recognise. And ultimately, they are going to be victorious, which is a real problem for the Turks because they've committed massively to overthrowing Assad, and it just ain't going to work.
Richard Thompson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2018, Lyubov Chernyukin, the wife of Vladimir Putin's former deputy finance minister, paid £20,000 for lunch with the then Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson, who we believe is soon to be ennobled. Could the Prime Minister remind the House once more why his government is yet to publish the Intelligence and Security Committee's report into alleged Russian interference in UK politics?
Prime Minister!
Well, as I think he knows very well, the report will be published as soon as the Intelligence and Security Committee is reconvened. And I think, as I've told the House several times before, those of a conspiratorial cast of mind will be disappointed by its findings.
Well, it's almost as if Boris is with you on this one, Martin.
How so?
Well, in Tony? That he thinks that this report is not going to be a big, important report, that it is about Russian interfering in
the
UK election.
What the report will show, I think, is that there's a massive amount of Russian oligarch money which is being channeled to the Conservative Party. But the Russian oligarchy are not the Russian government, and many of them are quite hostile to Putin and his policies. So the way people think about this is completely, manipulated. There's an awful lot of Russian oligarch money backing the Tory party, but that Russian oligarch money isn't pro-Putin. But nevertheless, they're trying to influence us.
Now, so by taking on the Syrians in Idlib, really, the Turkish army are also taking on the Russians, aren't they? Because they're also saying that...
Potentially,
you are,
yes.
Well, they are, because they're saying you will no longer be able to fly air support missions for your Syrian Arab army on the ground in Idlib.
Well, they can't anyway. They're not allowed to fly air support, which is one of the reasons why the terrorists are being pushed back, because they haven't got any air support.
I'm talking about the Syrian Arab army with their Russian air support.
Yeah, they've got Russian air support. The Turks aren't allowed to overfly. Yeah,
but the Turks are threatening.
Well, if they do,
the Russians
they'll be shot down. That's what's going to happen. I mean, there's a very interesting video up this week. People want to see it of because the US are still in part of the northeast of Syria, and they have a conflict with locals who is just saying get out of here, and then they open fire on the crowd which is attacking them, and kill a couple of people. And do you know what happened after that? Russian military police intervened and told the Americans to get out of there, otherwise they were going to be crucified.
The Americans and the Israelis still involved in Syria?
Of course they are.
I mean, we're not hearing much about that on the news,
are
we?
Of course they are. I mean, basically, the poor people of Syria have had these people in their face for the last 7 years, and they've killed hundreds of thousands of people, all of which has been orchestrated and paid for by our taxes, Tony. And the white helmets this week have been seen rescuing children from burning buildings,
well,
supposedly,
some...
all funded by our intelligence services, but of course they are embedded with Al-Qaeda, the people who supposedly bombed the Twin Towers. No, they didn't bomb, they flew planes into it. Although, of course, in actual fact, as Ian Henshaw will tell you, the buildings were bombed. And, of course, as Donald Trump said on the day...
I mean, it's probably fair to say they were explosives.
Don't collapse like that.
They were explosives inside the building.
Well, indeed. And then Donald Trump on the day said buildings don't collapse like that from planes crashing into them. And you know what? On that one occasion, he was right. They don't. So something else happened.
The other thing is, in Syria, seems to have really taken the brunt of Western policy. I mean, even in the 1980s, the Syrian civil war, the West was involved in that too.
Yeah. With hindsight, we can see that they were gunning for them all along. But ultimately, Syria is probably one of the more, it's a very mixed society. You've got a majority of Sunnis, but a big minorities of Alawites, basically Shia, and Christians. And it was basically probably the most, Damascus, probably the most tolerant place in the Middle East.
Are we going to see the Turks permanently take territory in the north of Syria now?
No, ultimately, the way the Syrian Arab Army has played this is they're playing a long game. They are going to win back every inch of Syrian territory, and Putin has said he's absolutely with that. Ultimately, the government in Syria is going to have 100% control of its oil and everything else.
But they don't
rush at it. One of the things is it's taken
Putin
so long.
Putin is only saying this, Martin, because he's got his naval bases and an air base in Syria.
Well, this is American thing. That the reason the Russians are doing this is because they've got a base there. They're doing it because ultimately the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is going to bring all these, you know, state-of-the-art railway and communications infrastructure through the Middle East, they've got to stabilise the situation if they're going to do that. And the Russians also take quite rightly the view that if we don't stop this stuff in Syria, we're going to have it in Chechnya, we're going to have it in Moscow, it's going to be in our face. And it's much more of a threat to them than it is to the people of the United States who live on the, live half a world away. And don't forget, the Syrians were the Russians' traditional allies. It's a bit like Britain saying we're going to defend Poland in 1939.
I thought Syria was connected up with France more.
Traditionally, France was the colonial power, but they were kicked out. And then, of course, the locals made friends with the Russians because they don't like the French. And the French, of course, have been as complicit as the British in wrecking the country because they couldn't control it. And lots of people ought to be sent to war crimes trials for all of this. It'll not happen, but they're not going to win either.
Let's go and have a look at Northern Ireland now. And there is a witch hunt, apparently, against former Ulster police officers. Again, this came up at Prime Minister's Questions. Quite a lot from that in the second hour this week.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Will the Prime Minister bring to an end the sickening outrage of a witch hunt against former police officers who served Ulster through the heat of the Troubles and are now going to face the most odious prosecutions for non-criminal misconduct? That wouldn't be tolerated in this part of the United Kingdom. It shouldn't be tolerated in my part of the United Kingdom. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we will make sure that we give support for all those who face unnecessary prosecution, and I'm well aware of the issue that he raises.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I can't remember the Tory minister that used to be responsible for Northern Ireland, who's been sacked in the reshuffle. But what he did is he agreed with the Republicans that there would be some investigation of RUC misbehaviour in the past. And that was one of the things that convinced them to go back into Stormont. Now, that wasn't cleared, apparently, with Johnson. So he wasn't happy about that. And therefore, the guy was axed. Now, the fact of the matter is that the RUC were involved in all sorts of murders and assassinations. The Lochin Island massacre, for example.
But just a minute. Surely, by the Good Friday Agreement, that means that if you start having a go at people on one side, you're going to have to do both sides.
No, well,
it's a bit of a truth and reconciliation moment.
Well, Sinn Féin have always said, we don't necessarily want prosecutions of individuals here. We want a full inquiry into what went on. Because, of course, underlying all of this is the fact that the British Army and the RUC were in bed with the Loyalist paramilitaries 100%. They gave them targeting information. They told them who to kill. So when people got
Did they actually pass explosives on
they
them?
They did indeed. The bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, it looks as if the explosives were given to them by MI5. Now, people on the Republican side in the six counties are very well aware of this history.
Why haven't we had an equivalent that they did in South Africa, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where all this stuff can come out in order?
Because the British government doesn't want one, because it will show the British state up for what the British state actually is. And basically, Sinn Féin didn't push for it on the basis that let's just get some kind of deal together here, so stop the killing. And that basically is more important than digging over the old stuff. But on the other hand, if people want to, ultimately, Britain has got to face up to what happened there. our security forces and intelligence services were heavily involved in loyalist paramilitary terrorism and killed hundreds of people. Now, the IRA people, who were also involved in murder and violence, they did years and years in prison. Not a single British general has done time in prison. Where is Brigadier Gordon Kerr these days?
Now, recently I did an interview...
The Metropolitan Police wanted him prosecuted.
Recently I did an interview with Chris Hewitt, who in Coventry was a journalist at the time of the Birmingham pub bombings, because there's still people, victims of families of the victims of the Birmingham pub bombings, who don't feel that that was looked into properly.
No, it wasn't. And of course, what they did is they just grabbed a random bunch of Irish guys and fitted them up for it, which of course is really bad.
And it's an interesting
bad policy, because it means the people who really did it are breathing a sigh of relief.
In a way, the Birmingham business and the Birmingham Six, the massive, well, probably one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in British history. And many people say that the inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings echoed some of the injustices of the Birmingham Six inquiry. This, let's have a listen now to Chris Hewitt. This is just an interview, also a clip of an interview I did with him on the Dialect Show a few weeks ago.
It was all timed so that the police would get there and get, you know, the bomb disposal people would get there and disarm the bombs. By the time they found a phone that worked that hadn't been vandalised, it was too late, because the warning got through and then the bombs went off shortly afterwards.
Who should be still possibly brought to book, if anybody, for this?
Well, the five people involved, three of which are dead.
So do we know who they were?
The police do. All five were given letters of immunity from prosecution under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement.
I mean, how has this gone down amongst the families of the victims in Birmingham?
Well, a lot of the families, I don't think the families have been told about this.
So how come you know and they don't?
Well, because 3 days afterwards, at about 2:05, I was walking past Coventry's police station and a group of coppers who were just knocking off duty knew I was a working journalist and called me over and told me the serious crime squad had arrested the wrong people. And the suggestion was I should look for the third bomb, because the third bomb was planted after these people were in custody, so they couldn't have done it. Then, worst of all, the five people actually responsible were flew out from Birmingham Airport on the morning of the third day, dressed as businessmen. They then went to European airports that had direct Aer Lingus flights with the Republic.
So, Martin, this is it's a quite extraordinary state of affairs with Birmingham, wasn't it, where you've got Special Branch about to arrest, within 24 hours or so of arresting the people they believe had planted these bombs, some of whom they had been following, and then they were told, get off the case, the West Midland Serious Crime Squad are taking over, who then arrested a random bunch of people to allow the real perpetrators to get away. This is pretty damn shocking stuff, isn't it?
Let's unpick this a bit. I don't think the West Midland Serious Crime Squad did it in order to prevent the arrest of the real perpetrators. I think they were just incompetent and very nasty. They got a reputation for many, many years of basically fitting people up.
But why would they shut down a live investigation that was about to bring arrests?
Well, that would imply that the IRA are cooperating with the deep state in Britain to bomb people in Birmingham, which I don't think was the case.
No, not necessarily. It would mean Martin, listen to me here. There were people within the British state, within the Home Office, etc., who had decided that they wanted these people from the IRA to get off on this occasion, for whatever reason, doesn't mean to say they're cooperating.
You can say that, but I don't believe that was the case. I think what happened was that, as the journalist pointed out, the real problem for the IRA was that they planned to phone in a warning so that the bombs would go off but nobody would be hurt. But there was no, this is the 1970s in Birmingham, they couldn't find a functioning phone that hadn't been vandalised. Yeah. So basically, the whole thing was a mess up by the IRA. But I don't think the IRA then had its back covered by the West Midlands police. The West Midlands police were basically racist thugs, and they just grabbed the first people they could get hold of, beat the hell out of them, and then beat confessions out of them, and that then solves the case. Although, of course, it didn't solve the case. And, of course, we could talk about other atrocities. I mentioned the Birmingham, Dublin and Monaghan bombs earlier. 27 people died in those bombs.
We don't need to talk about those again. Let's have a
more people died than in Birmingham, though. Irish people. And that was done by MI5 and the loyalists. And nobody's been prosecuted for that either.
Martin.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So let's have a listen now to Ellen Brown. She is a monetary reform author in the United States, and she has got some thoughts about something that Martin brings up quite a lot on here, which is the only part of the US which has got its own nationalized bank, that is to say a state bank.
We have one stellar model, which is the Bank of North Dakota, and it's been around for 100 years. According to the Wall Street Journal, it's more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, but they're not even trying to be profitable. Their mandate is to serve the public interest. But it's just a more efficient model that they're just like a co-op. You know, the whole state works like a co-op, sharing their own profits, not sending it off to Wall Street and reinvesting them in their own communities. So they make below-market loans. And all the state's deposits go in the Bank of North Dakota. Then we have, historically, we've had public banks, and we've had government-issued money, which was the original colonial model. So that was what my first book on this subject was about, Web of Debt, where money comes from, how we lost the power to issue money. But it should be us issuing the money. In fact, according to the Bank of England, 97% of the money supply is created by banks when they make loans. So if we, the people, want to regain control of issuing the money supply, we need to recapture the banks.
Recapture the banks. That's Ellen Brown. I'll put a link up to her book on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But she's really saying, look, money is a utility, just like water, gas or something like that. It needs to be in national hands.
Yeah, and of course,
and not a racket.
And in the Bank of North Dakota, you've got a functioning example of exactly that. It's not like a fantasy. It's been running for 100 years, very successful.
So we have listen now to a guy called Fritz Springmeier. Now, Martin, is it anyone that says the word Illuminati some sort of conspiracy nutcase?
No, the Illuminati existed and probably still exists, but the problem with it is that people put up, it's like ley lines. You know, do ley lines exist? Well, some people think they do, and some people think they don't.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Fritz Springmeier. The reason I bring this up is because we're in a situation with these special advisors who quite often stay there, depending on... We are focusing on Sajid Javid and he's being sacked. Mm-hmm. But actually, there's quite a lot of advisors who are there all the time as a kind of permanent government. So let's have a listen to what he's got to say about this potential sort of things behind the scenes, families behind the scenes, owners of the country behind the scenes, making big decisions and, in fact, deciding on policy.
The Illuminati is the continuation of the mystery religions. There was quite a number of mystery religions in antiquity, and these mystery religions had councils that controlled them, and then there was a supreme council that operated clear from India to the British Isles that then coordinated all of these mystery religions. And that would be the today what we call the hierarchy of the Illuminati.
So the Illuminati is basically just an extension of the mystery religion system, the whole type of philosophy.
Yes, it was a way of hoarding knowledge and power to a few special people.
And how do they hoard the knowledge?
When I say knowledge, some of the knowledge is pseudo-knowledge, and some of the knowledge is scientific knowledge, which enabled, for instance, Christopher Columbus to be certain that he could sail across the Atlantic and hit land. He was associated with the Knights Templars, which is one of these secret societies associated with the Illuminati. So you've got different types of knowledge, but some of the knowledge is actually bogus. It's just claimed so that they can get people to join whatever mystery religion they're trying to offer.
Okay, Fritz. Now, why are families so important in this? It's obviously, you titled it Bloodlines, and mm-hmm. that must have to do with the families. Why are they so important?
It has to do with how they pass power from one generation to another. It also involves the occult powers. They try to have full-blooded members. They believe that, at least the traditionalists within the Illuminati, which are the full-blooded members, they believe that to really be powerful with all the occult powers that demonology gives you, that you have to be a member who's got a genealogy that goes back many years.
Or why should we even be worried about the Illuminati? If there's just a structure that's out there with anarchy and then there's the top structure that controls the anarchy level, isn't that just some type of contained system within itself? Why should we, as just normal everyday people, be worried about this?
Well, the general public, as you probably know, is not concerned about this, but they should be, because all kinds of things, all aspects of their lives are influenced by these people. They're the movers and shakers of the world. There's some disinformation out there that I need to clarify, and that is the misunderstanding that's common out there is that this man, Adam Weishaupt, which was a pseudonym, a name that he had taken actually, started the Illuminati. He did create a modern structure for it. He was paid by these families to create a modern structure. But he didn't originate the Illuminati. The Illuminati goes back thousands of years before him. And the reason why I mention this is that if we go back into antiquity, we will see that there were certain families that were deified as gods, like Pharaoh, Alexander the Great. Maybe some of the viewers don't know that Alexander the Great believed that he was descended from gods. Genghis Khan, who's still worshipped in Mongolia. These powerful families believed they were gods, and they controlled through their priesthoods in these mystery religions their the people that were subservient to them. They never wanted to relinquish power. They networked together, and over history, you can never find any point in history where they gave up their power. What they did is they did a lot of sleight of hands and went underground or behind the scenes and let other people become frontmen, but they've still stayed in power. You can see a lot of, I give a lot of evidence of that in my Bloodlines of the Illuminati book. Just some everyday examples that I ran into is, as a boy, you know, I met Henry Cabot Lodge, and someone who would read American history would know about John Cabot exploring the United States, which was of the Italian Caboto family. This is an ancient family, and yet you can see their influence in history all down through the years. Recently there was a book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Well, I say recent, it's not been recent, but it became a bestseller, and then the authors made a trilogy of books, Messianic Legacy and The Temple and the Lodge, and Pageant and Lay and Lincoln were the authors of that trilogy of books. And they go in and discuss how all of the royalty and aristocrats of Europe are descended from one single bloodline. Now, of course, then when you go to look at our presidents, you find that 11 of our presidents, at least 11, are part of that bloodline.
At least 11 presidents are descendants from European royalty.
The Merovingian dynasty, at least 11. And I have, in the talks that I've given in the last couple days here in Austin, I showed a genealogy chart that I have, which shows 12 of the American presidents very closely related.
Okay, Fritz. Well, you talked about how these Illuminati families, when they have power and we can see that, then they go into hiding. Most people would say that the Templars, the Knights Templars, were one of these Illuminati structures. Could you explain basically how they supposedly went into hiding? Because you hear about the Templars, they had quite a long reign, and then the French turned against them, and then they were outlawed by the Pope, and then they just disappeared out of history.
Right, and but they didn't. Although the Pope outlawed them, they were able to flee, and initially they went to places in Spain and Portugal, and from there they boarded ships and they sailed to Scotland. And there was a decision made to give Scotland its independence, and the Knights Templars that landed in Scotland then in the Battle of Bannockburn helped the Scottish gain their independence, and then became very prominent in the affairs of Scotland.
Well, you know, Fritz, I saw the movie Braveheart, and I don't remember them being any Templar knights in that movie.
Yes, that's true, but the movie ended before the Battle of Bannockburn.
Oh, all right, I understand now. Okay, well, Fritz, now that we know basically a little bit about the Illuminati and about how they structure their system, can you give us a little bit of the mindset of these Illuminati families? I mean, why do these families, these 13 families and other families, feel that they have the right or the authority to control almost every aspect of our lives?
These families, since antiquity, have believed that they were gods. And of course, they have been worshipped in many periods as gods. And they continue to pass that prideful belief down from one generation to another. They believe that they're a superior being. Oftentimes, when I've seen quotes by these people or heard people relate what they heard, you see that they refer to us as ants or cattle, and that's, they basically have the idea that they were born to be gods and rule us, and we were born to serve them.
Well, he finishes there by saying, we were born to serve them. That's Fritz Springmeier, I think, speaking in the mid-1990s to Jeff Contreras in Austin, Texas, on their little cable channel. Martin, you know, what do you make of that? He's making quite a lot of claims, isn't he? But there may be a shred of truth in that there are very wealthy, powerful people that see us as just pawns in their game.
The shred of truth is that the ruling classes do stick together and intermarry and try and dominate things, but they don't always succeed, and the idea that there's one controlling center is simply historically inaccurate. I mean, the idea that the Templars had a big role in the Battle of Bannockburn is just wrong. They didn't.
What about this idea, though, that, that throughout history there have been these organizations that try and take power effectively and control money?
We're talking about power struggles in the US elections, we're talking about power struggles in the British cabinet. Power struggles have always gone on, and certain groups have tried to dominate, but that doesn't mean that there's a continuity. There's as much discontinuity in history as continuity. It's messy.
Let's go finally to have a look at Israel, and I thought we'd have a listen to Doreen Dotton this week. Because she is very concerned. She believes that there are moral Jews and Nazi Jews. That's what she calls them, Martin. I mean, that there are different types of Jews who are both in and outside of Israel actually making things extremely difficult for moral Jews. Let's hear what she's got to say.
We've got a problem here. You've got a deep state. We've got a state. And there is no doubt about the fact that the Nazis that are embedded here are cooperating with the Nazis that are embedded in the United States, are cooperating with the Nazis that are embedded in Europe. And we have to take care of all of this. And if you go around and blame all of the Jews for what's going on, you are a Nazi agent, either knowingly or not knowingly. And it has gotten to a point where I'm hearing Gentiles saying, the Nazis were demonized. They were actually right about the Jews. You see what the Jews are like? It's not us that's doing it. It's the Nazis that's doing it. Some of those Nazis are Jews. And their sworn enemy are the moral Jews. And when you spit their vomit all over creation and make us all look bad, You're cutting off the branch that you're sitting on. Because the moral Jews have always been the purveyors of morality in the world. If you don't have us in the world, there will be no morality in the world. We were the ones who came into the world to bring the morality. Everything you think you know about morality, you have learned from us. You do not honor your teachers. You think it's coming from you. It's not. Every good impulse you have, every good thought that you have, every good instinct that you have, everything that you know about morality, you have gotten from us. And if we're not here, you will be in hell. It is your interest to keep the moral Jews alive, because every flower that flowers in this world is because we learn Torah correctly. You get rid of us, you don't have a flower. You don't have a flower, you don't have food, you don't have anything. It is in your interest to keep the good Jews alive. Make no mistake about it.
That's Israeli Jew Doreen Dotton there, worried, Martin, that her faith, her religion is being taken over, and she says by Nazi Jews.
Well, in Israel itself, it's fairly common for people of a certain political persuasion to accuse other people of being like the Nazis. But of course, if you're not Jewish and you're not from Israel, comparing the state of Israel to Nazism is construed as anti-Semitic. Now, it's certainly the case that the Jabotinskyite right in Israel base themselves on Mussolini, no doubt about it.
Okay, so that's time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Chris Windows and also Matthew Montague Pollock. You'll find this show's story, links, podcast, comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy on Saturday morning and Sunday evenings at 7, Danny Lopsch. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless.